The Daily.
It is The Daily here on TRE with me, Dave Hodgson, and we're going to be talking to Helen Barrell. She's a librarian at the University of Birmingham. She's appeared on BBC 4's Punt P, has written for magazines such as 14 Times and Family Tree, and guest blogs for Find My Past. Her first book, Poison Panic and Arsenic Deaths in 1840s Essex, was published by Pen and Sword back in 2016, and we're talking about her new book, Fatal Evidence, Professor Alfred Swain Taylor and the Dawn of Forensic Science. Good afternoon. How are you, Helen?
Hello, yes, I'm very well, thank you.
Sounds like you've been busy with all that stuff going on there.
It's quite a lot, isn't it?
So just tell us a little bit about what you do at the University of Birmingham then, your role there as a librarian. That's must be quite an interesting job.
Well, yeah, I've worked as a librarian there ever since I graduated, and I've worked in different sorts of libraries. So I work in the main library now. I used to work in the art and music library. I worked in a medical school library. So it's just really interesting, and I like working with students and young people and researchers finding out interesting things. So I suppose it rubs off, and then I end up writing books.
Not every time I watch the news, but a lot on the news in the UK at the moment is the fact that libraries are actually disappearing. When I was born in Derby and lived there most of my life, and we had a local library, and I don't think it's there anymore because of the way technology and so on. Is that still the case, or are libraries still popular?
Because I work at the university, then obviously
you've got a lot of
use books, especially history people, especially. But and there's a lot of electronic resources, but of course they're all managed by the library, so we look after those and we help people how to use them. So there's a lot of training and things, and educating people on how to, like fake news. We're trying to make sure students understand how to make sure the facts they find, how to verify facts and all that sort of thing as well. So
something about a book, you just feel it's a bit more trustworthy. There was on the news the other day saying that. Actually, e-books are not outselling traditional paperback or hardback books. And we still love... I like to hold a proper book in my hand still.
Yes, I think I've seen this. The Society of Authors have been saying a lot about this because there was a massive burst of people buying e-books and e-readers and things, and that's kind of tailed off now, really. People got quite excited about them, and then I think people who like reading them, they just go on and read them, and other people just go... Oh, I like having, an actual physical copy. I mean, I like both, actually. Yeah. But probably because I work in a big building full of books, I'm quite happy with an e-book as well as an actual book as well.
Absolutely, I understand. Because we get a lot of books to the show here, and so I get to read them. But it's nice. But also, if you got a whole library on your iPad or on your Kindle, you really can't show off very much, can you? You know, when you invite people around the house and you've got all your books on the wall.
No, that's true. Well, they did actually do an experiment with I can't remember if it was an iPad or a Kindle, and they weighed one that was like didn't have any books on it, and then one that had loads and loads of e-books, and the one that had e-books on it was slightly heavier than the one that
really
didn't. Yeah. So e-books actually have a weight, which is quite an astonishing thought, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I assume your book's going to be available in all different kinds of formats. It's called Fatal Evidence, Professor Alfred Swain Taylor and the Dawn of Forensic Science. Why did you decide to do this book focusing on this amazing professor?
Well, he turned up when I was writing Poison Panic. Poison Panic came into being because I was transcribing a parish register and I found a note about somebody who'd been poisoned with arsenic. And I became fascinated by it. Some of my family were involved, which I don't want to go into, really. But Professor Taylor kept turning up again.
I want to know now.
he kept turning up. He was doing all of the analyses, and it was always in it for poisons. But then there was this case in Essex where a woman was strangled, and he actually was called in to analyse stains on a pair of trousers, which were blood. And this was 1850. And I was like, I didn't know they could actually do that in 1850. I mean, he had to do it visually, like looking at the stains. There wasn't like an actual the test that came later. But it was fascinating. And he's only really known for the Smethurst and like the Thomas Smethurst and William Palmer poison trials, because they were quite difficult, complicated cases, I think. And he's kind of been a bit, because of the difficulty of those cases, I think people tend to think he was a bit you know, he was all mouth and no trousers, and he was a bit, he wasn't very good. But when I actually started researching him, I just became fascinated by him, all the different cases he worked on, and the different cases that other people did that he collated in all these huge number of books and articles he wrote. So he's really, really quite an important chap who's been forgotten, I think.
So what did he really discover then in his time? Because, I mean, obviously there's a legacy for us here today.
He did. I mean, he's in sort of formal forensic science as we know it now. It didn't really exist in the early 19th century. Mm. They'd have different tests and things, but it wasn't something that they could even study at university. And there was like a fight early on in the 19th century to get medical students and law students learning about it, because obviously it's quite important. It's where law and medicine sort of cross over. But they didn't have, because it was very new, they didn't have books, textbooks and things. And so he was like one of the earliest people to actually put all this knowledge together, and so that people had a reference, so that if you were a doctor in some far-flung village and there was a poisoning in your village, you could take his book off your shelf and he'd give you a step-by-step guide on how to actually perform an analysis, things like that. So he is actually quite important, and we kind of can see little shadows of him now, even in, like, for instance, the character of Sherlock Holmes. Mm. I think there are elements of him which come from Professor Taylor, just because Conan Doyle, when he was training as a doctor, he would have been reading his books. And even Professor Taylor's massive sarcasm, I think, sometimes comes out in those characters. And people like Dorothy Sayers, she used him in his books when she was doing her research for her novels. And even Wilkie Collins, who's the Victorian chap who wrote things like The Moonstone and The Woman in White, he was using Professor Taylor's books as well. So even if you pick up a crime novel, you will see little shadows of him will be there as well.
Not sure if you covered this in the book, but before this evidence was available to us, and the likes of Professor Alfred Swain Taylor really kind of grappling with this and discovering this, were they saying, you know what, if only we had the technology, we'd be able to look at this bit of blood here and decide what, or was it completely, they were in oblivion to it completely?
It's hard to know, really. I think they just sort of... I think the Victorians had this kind of attitude about, you know, new things and new technologies, and they were always fascinated by what they could discover and what they could find out. And so you find... Professor Taylor has this kind of attitude of being quite excited about things, like photography. So he's there one minute, he's sort of examining somebody's innards for poison, and then he's going, oh, someone's just made this discovery about how you can make photographs. Oh, I'm going to do that. Oh, he uses chemicals. I can do chemicals. Ah, oh, look, chemicals. Ah, oh, he has a go. It doesn't quite work. Then he uses his own knowledge to kind of change the way that, you know, the suggested way of doing it. And then he finds his own way of doing it, and he writes about it, and he tells the Royal Society. So there's this great sharing of ideas and things like that. And I think there were times where they'd have a crime, and then they'd go, if only we could know how, you know, if we could have done, you know, it's interesting though, because there is a lag, they say, usually of about 30 years between someone discovering something and then someone realizing you can use it for crime, which is a similar sort of thing to DNA when they started noticing that in the 1980s, and then it took several years for them to actually develop it and work out how they could actually use it to catch criminals. And so you see a sort of similar thing going on earlier,
and probably even more years before it became widespread across most police forces in the UK and around the world. It's even now, I suppose, still not everywhere, but would he be a bit of a 19th century geek, would you say? You know, if he was around today, would he be would he be like into his Apple stuff? And seems like he was into his technology and very passionate about some of this stuff.
Probably would be, yes. I mean, I have to say, I was at the Crime Writers Association conference in Edinburgh a few months ago, and they had a talk from a forensic pathologist, and he was talking, and when he was talking, I thought, it's so weird, he sounds like how I'd imagine Professor Taylor. And he was very sort of like, I go into the witness box, and then the judge is telling me off, saying, you're not supposed to educate people, you're just supposed to give us the facts, and then I say, yes, okay, then, and then I just carry on as I was, and I thought, he's so much like Professor Taylor. But interestingly, he's the man that Anne Cleves bases her forensic pathologists on in her novels, so for like Vera and Shetland, which was bizarre. And he was there. He was like the modern Professor Taylor. And of course, now they've got all their technologies that they use, so they all have to gown up and go to crime scenes. And Professor Taylor didn't go to crime scenes; he was sent things.
Yeah.
But you know, it's, I think he probably would. He has that sort of spirit of adventure and you know, wanting to discover things and really. He had this idea, what he was doing was for the good of humanity. So he wanted to, you know, catch criminals, but also to use his knowledge sometimes to save people who were in the dock accused of a murder, and he could prove that they hadn't done it. So it's, you know, it's actually, there's like, you know, there's two sides to the coin there, really.
It was a quest for him, really. It was a calling, maybe, even, he felt.
I think so. I think, and he felt so passionate about it. During the trial of William Palmer, and people were sort of trying to undermine the evidence, and it was kind of quite dangerous for toxicologists in a way. He almost felt like they were undermining his entire discipline to get this one man off. And he said, what is one man's life in the face of several millions? You know, and he's there talking about the entire safety of everyone in Britain from poisoners. He was possibly a little paranoid, I think, but he was making a point, you know, and he was the person who was inevitably called on to examine people and find out how someone had died, and he'd seen all these deaths that could have been avoided, and you can kind of really get that passion that he feels for, like, you know, like this great vocation of his. I'm a surgeon, I'm good at chemistry, I can combine these two things, and I can, you know, save people. So.
Did he ever overstep his, it feels like he probably did, but you can probably correct me if I'm wrong here, did he ever overstep his remit and actually, as an expert witness, did he ever say, you know, actually, I think he did it because of this, that and the other, and really that's not his position to say that, of course.
Careful with what he would say, and he'd had so much experience of being in the courtroom that it's quite interesting to read his replies to like counsel who were examining him and cross-examining him, and how he phrases things very carefully. But he does, at the William Palmer trial, he does get quite shirty, and it is quite funny. And he says, "On my oath, this is the worst deception ever performed upon a scientist." And he's talking there about a journalist who came round his house, as Taylor said, pretending to be from an insurance company, and then later turned up with an article going, "Oh, actually, I wrote this article." And Taylor was furious because the journalist had a letter of introduction from Faraday, who is like this famous scientist of the day, and Taylor's not going to turn someone away who's, you know, recommended by Faraday. And then he found out they played a trick on him, and he got very annoyed. But you can kind of hear him getting annoyed when you read it. And then he wrote this very, very sarcastic and not very academic journal article in Riposte, where he kept being very rude to the other people. So he's quite a character.
It sounds like it, yeah.
That's safe to say.
We're talking to Helen Barrell. Did I say your second name correctly, or Barrell?
It's a Suffolk surname, so it's probably pronounced like Barrell or something like that.
Okay, so
I don't know, Barrell or Barrell would do.
Not a Midlander, then.
No.
The book's called Fatal Evidence, Professor Alfred Swain Taylor and the Dawn of Forensic Science. It sounds like you probably already alluded to this a little bit, but did he take it personally when he was challenged? Because this was his baby, really, in some respects.
Yes, he didn't like being challenged by people. He got very upset. I mean, there's some people who he didn't mind. He had a colleague called George Owen Rees at Guy's Hospital, and he worked with Bright and did lots of stuff on kidneys and blood, and he was very clever, and Taylor had a lot of time for him, and they worked together, and if he said, actually, I don't think this is, you shouldn't really be using that because that could be contaminated and stuff, and he'd go, oh, yes, that's fine, yes, and I need actually quote his friend in his articles. But there was some scientists he really never got on with, and that's William Herapath and Henry Lesby.
Moriarty.
And there were really angry things that they'd fight. They'd be like sending really fearsome letters to each other through the Lancet and stuff like that. And they're just really funny. And nowadays, I don't think you tend to get that tone in things like the Lancet, but if you ever see academics fighting on Twitter, that's what it makes me think of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's really funny. You used the wrong sort of copper. I did not. And it goes on and on and on. You know, and the editor eventually steps in and goes, okay, guys, that's enough.
We need them around today. We need those type of people today because, you know, all the stuff that's going out there on the internet of, you know, you can't eat this. I mean, I was watching a video the other day, yesterday, today actually, saying you can't eat eggs because they're high in cholesterol. Well, that's now changed, but those that information's still out there. So we need people like that around today who are passionate about what they believe in and getting the truth out there as well. Now, I'm intrigued, Helen. Tell me about the skeleton in the carpet bag.
Oh, yes. This is the unsolved case, the Waterloo Bridge mystery in the 1850s. Basically, there were some boys who were rowing across the river near Bow Street, and they saw a carpet bag on the buttresses under the bridge, and they thought, oh, what's this? And they thought it was a great prize, as it was said in the papers, you know, perhaps it's some money or something. And they opened it up, and it was the partial skeletal remains of somebody with some clothes, basically.
Wow.
And they never ever found, they never identified the victim, and they never found a perpetrator. They never found the head or the hands or the feet. But there was this clue, which was the man who ran the toll gate on the bridge was a former member of the Met, and he was very observant. And he noticed the night before that the bag was found, a woman who was carrying a very distinctive-looking bag, and that was the bag that was found. And he described her to the police, and, you know, but what he said was he thinks that she had grey hair, but he says he thinks she powdered her hair. And nobody, none of the police said, well, it was a very heavy bag. He had to help her carry it over the toll gate. They said she must have got a cab to get to the bridge, but no cabbies recognised her at all.
Right.
They had the Professor Taylor helped the police surgeon at Bow, and they sort of worked out from what was left of this person roughly how tall they would have been, that it was a man, all these sorts of things. From the clothes, they tried to work out how the person had died, but Taylor said, because people were going, well, they must have been stabbed, and they've paint on their back, so they must have fallen against the wall as they were stabbed. But he said, you can't definitively say that those clothes belong to that person. You could say they might have done, but you can't say they definitely were, which is quite, you know, he's quite good on that sort of thing. And they never, as far as the newspapers were concerned, it was never solved. A soldier in Colchester said he'd done it, and then they said, no, you haven't actually, you're just mad. And there was a Scottish boy who was walking around town with bones in his pockets, and he ran away from the police, and they chased after him, and they said, why did you run from us? And they went, I've got bones in my pocket, and I thought you'd think I'd killed the man in the carpet bag. But eventually, Professor Taylor wrote about the case some years later, and he said the closest the police got was thinking it was actually a Swedish sailor whose boat had been in the river, and they think and part of this reason that they think it was the way that his socks had been knitted, that they weren't knitted in the English way.
Wow.
And that in those days British men wore their collars turned up, and he had his collar turned down, and they said, well, he must have been European. So it's fascinating, but that's what they thought it was. And I quite like Nordic noir and things like that, and there's a series called The Bridge, and I love
yes.
The Bridge. And I just think when I suddenly got to the end of reading about the skeleton on the bridge, I thought, this sounds like The Bridge. And then when they thought it was a Swedish sailor, I thought, it's an early Nordic noir. But I love that. I find that case fascinating, really. And somebody somewhere is doing their family tree going, well, where did that sailor go?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Still to this day,
yeah. He's in the carpet bag.
What is today around in our criminal justice system, whether it be in the UK or the States, that we can owe to Professor Taylor? What legacy is there?
Well, one of the legacies is he was very vocal about the way that expert witnesses were treated at like coroner's inquests and things. And he said, you know, they're not properly paid for the work they do. So he helped formalise that, so that now when there's an inquest, partly the way that they run them is based on his recommendations, like for paying people, and also like the more sort of aspect of what experts you get in and what the experts should be doing. And obviously that changes over the years as different kinds of evidence come in, like DNA, you know, which is the massive change that they've had. But that's one of the things that he brought in, really, I think. And also this idea of people learning about it, like so students, medical students learning about like how law affects medicine. And he was one of the people who pushed for it, and he taught. And his sort of way of teaching and his way of laying out his lessons and his books and things have obviously had an influence over the years on how that's done today.
Helen, it sounds like that you got a little bit of a soft spot for old Professor Taylor.
I think he just reminded me of me. very sarcastic.
Well, when you're researching somebody to this extent, he's not here anymore, but you must feel like you know them a little bit.
I do a bit, actually. I do. I think it would be fun to meet him, like get in a time machine and meet him. I mean, I do have a Victorian costume, so if I do find a working time machine, I can at least be in the right clothes when I arrive.
There we are. Now, that is very geeky, what you just said, but that's absolutely true. I'm right with you on that one.
I've been a pair of jeans. I would just be like, what's going on?
Oh, dear. It's fun. It's great, really is. And you sound so passionate about it as well, so it's great to have you on talking about it. The book's called Fatal Evidence, Professor Alfred Swain Taylor and the Dawn of Forensic Science. It's available on talkradioeurope.com. If you go onto our website, click onto our bookshop banner, you will find yourself a copy that way. Of course, other places online as well. And is this your second book now, Helen?
It is, yes.
Oh, how did the first one go? Were you happy with it?
Yes, I was, yes.
Good,
yes.
Good. And this one's been available for a while, has it now?
Poison Panic was out last year, and you can still buy it. But Fatal Evidence, it's actually published on Sunday, but you can pre-order it now. So.
Any more appearances on Radio 4? Is it BBC 4's Punt P? What is that? Tell me more about that.
Punt PI. It's, you know, Steve.
I said Punt P, didn't I?
Punt and Dennis. Okay. Punt Pie. It's Steve Punt from Punt and Dennis.
Yeah.
And he basically explores mysterious things. And he was exploring this another skeleton, which was in the village that was opposite the one I grew up in Essex. And they basically, this woman who was an actress, she disappeared. And then they found a skeleton in her house. And so they asked me to help because I've done a lot of research on like families and things in that area, because it's where a lot of my family are from. So that was it. It was quite fun. I did quite a lot of research on that as well. At the same time as doing Professor Taylor, so I had skeletons coming out of my ears, basically.
Sounds very gruesome, but very interesting nonetheless. Helen, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate your time this afternoon, and we wish you all the very best with the book.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen. All right, bye-bye.